All right, folks, I'm here to talk to you about the subject of transferring juvenile cases. I'll tell you the funny thing. I was visiting with a judge from Reno, and I kept saying, hey, you really ought to go to this class. I'm going to be honest with you. I thought Katie was teaching this class. We've been taking turns teaching this. So I'm happy to talk to you all about this subject because it really is an important topic, and it's something that we've discovered throughout the year that as we poll judges and we talk to them, many municipal judges and justices of the peace are either not clear about what this area of the law requires them to do, when they have discretion to not transfer, when they're required to make the transfer. And to be honest with you, I've had a couple of judges who have just flat out said, Ryan, I didn't know that this law existed. If you fall in that category, we're here to cure you. We're here to give you the 50-minute solution. I can't promise in the next 50 minutes that by the time we're done, you'll all be prettier, but I promise you, you'll be better off for having come to this session. So here are our learning objectives for the hour. By the end of the session, participants are going to be able to identify the statutory authority for transferring juvenile cases from municipal and justice courts to juvenile courts. You'll be able to describe instances where a court may transfer or must transfer a case to juvenile court. And then we're also going to very briefly, if time allows, list some possible criteria for discretionary transfers from a municipal and justice court to a juvenile court. So I'd like to see a quick show of hands. How many of you routinely transfer things on a discretionary basis? You transfer them just because you feel like the situation warrants it, okay? How many of you have never transferred a case? Okay. Probably y'all need to tune in good because once a person has two convictions, okay, unless it's traffic or tobacco, the law requires you to transfer unless you have a juvenile case manager. Okay, and then let me ask y'all this: how many of you have? How many of you? This is news to you. The fact that we're saying that you have to transfer something you were unaware of. Okay, don't be ashamed. That's fine. There's plenty of folks. I'm even explaining to you why I think a lot of people were unclear on the law. Has to do with the fact that this provision doesn't live in Chapter 45 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. It's probably where it should live. All the other rules that are specific to municipal and justice courts live in Chapter 45. This bad boy lives over in the Family Code. And that might be one of the reasons why some folks are unaware of it. Okay, I'm curious to know how many of you are relatively new to me. Just been doing this, let's say, for like the last 5 years. Last 5 years? Okay. Well, I think it's going to be beneficial for all of us to talk about how we got to where we are and why we're having this discussion today and why it's such an important topic. Because the Texas juvenile justice system, this will be your, I guess we'll call this your 3-minute cram course, an overview of the Texas juvenile justice system. The Texas juvenile justice system does not look like any other juvenile justice system in the United States of America. It has some very unique, distinct features. First of all, there's two components to the Texas juvenile justice system. There is a civil component and there is a criminal component. And when you talk to most folks, even lawyers, about juvenile justice, they don't delineate it in their mind. They think there's only one system. In reality, the system that most people are thinking about when you talk to them about the juvenile justice system is the civil juvenile justice system, which consists of juvenile probation officers, juvenile courts, okay, and the much maligned and soon to be historically relic dustbin material, the Texas Youth Commission, TYC and TJPC. When I talk to you about the juvenile justice system, that's all that most people are thinking about. But there is a criminal justice system component as well, and that's what y'all are part of. Y'all are part of the criminal justice system that we have created. And I have begun recently in the last year when I talk to public policymakers and advocates and journalists and things like that, I go to great pains now when I'm talking about this publicly to talk about the civil juvenile justice system and the criminal juvenile justice system because we really need to increase awareness as to which part we are, what part we're working in, so that we can better state our needs and talk about the problems that we're seeing in our part of the pond. Let's talk about what the pond looks like annually in the state of Texas. This is data from 2009, and it shows the number of cases that were filed in just 1 year. And now I have given one-hour presentations just talking about this one singular slide. I had a chance to, I was invited by Carl Reynolds to have a visit with Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court to brief him on some of these issues. And this one slide alone pretty much flummoxed the Chief Justice, as it does most people when they take a look at this, because most people really have no clue of where the filings are that relate to these children who engaged in prohibited types of conduct. For those of you, and I'd like to see a show of hands, how many of you practice juvenile law? Do we have any folks who practice juvenile law, any juvenile law experience? Okay, no one in here? Then let's go ahead and walk through these, because I want to make sure that we're clear on what these mean. First of all, when I talk to you about a certified felony, I'm talking to you about a felony committed by a child that is initially processed into the civil juvenile justice system. A hearing has been conducted, and because of the nature of the offense and because of the age of the defendant, typically we're talking about like 14-year-old or 16-year-old who's committed an aggravated felony, okay? In certain circumstances, Texas law allows that child to be certified to stand trial as an adult, okay? Once they're certified to stand trial as an adult, their case is no longer heard in a juvenile court. Rather, it's heard in a state district court, all right? Now, that is, as you can see, in 2009, we had 202 times in which a child was certified to stand trial as an adult. The general rule, not just in Texas historically, but throughout the United States of America, is that children are not to be prosecuted criminally. That's the rule, okay? As you can see, our chart here clearly shows, however, that's not what's occurring. The vast majority of children who are being adjudicated and processed through our court system are being processed as children in municipal and justice courts. In other states, they would be processed probably not by any court. They'd be dealt with informally by juvenile probation services, social services, things of that nature. But they wouldn't be processed criminally. Or maybe they'd be processed by their state's juvenile courts. Okay, let's now talk about our first classification of what you see here in this chart. There were 1,027 cases filed in year 2009 that were what we call CHINs, okay? Or child in need of supervision, conduct in need of supervision. I quite often hear these terms used interchangeably. Let me talk to you in simple terms about what this means. This is something that is not a good idea that the legislature has officially said is a bad idea. The most common example of CHIN crime in the state of Texas. Now, there have been efforts every session that I have worked in the legislative process, and I've been an observer for, I guess, what, six sessions now. Without fail, there is always a bill that attempts to criminalize running away from home. They want to make it a Class C misdemeanor to run away from home. I want you to think about how asinine this is on a couple of levels. First of all, we already know that too often, it's not the child ends up paying these fines, it's the mom and dad. And we also know that sometimes the reason why these kids are running away from home is because of mom and dad, and we also know sometimes they have a damn good reason to be running away from mom and dad. And so think of CHINs as your textbook example of running away from home as a textbook example of CHINs. Let me give you some other instances. Believe it or not, possession of paint, of aerosol paint by a minor, that's a crime, okay? Huffing paint, however, is not a crime, but it is CHINs, okay? So folks who like to sit around and inhale fumes that destroy brain cells, it's not illegal, but once again, it's not a good idea. That's CHINs. Now, and here is the big kicker, and the one that I find very disturbing, which I think kind of explains what we're dealing with right now in the municipal and justice court universe. Class C misdemeanors are considered to be CHINs. You heard me right. These are this is an exception to CHINs, because whereas everything else I've named to you is not illegal, it's just not a good idea, okay, it's not criminal, I should say, Class C misdemeanors are CHINs. I mean, they are crimes. They are illegal. And they're additionally classified as being things that are not a good idea to do. The reason why this is such an interesting phenomenon is because, in theory, with the exception of traffic and tobacco, as I'll explain in a few minutes, absolutely every single case down here at the other end of the pool, okay, all these Class C misdemeanors can and historically were filed in our civil juvenile justice system. The vast majority of them were dealt with informally by probation officers. The vast majority of them never resulted in a trip to juvenile court, but we had a paradigm shift. We had a paradigm shift, and it kind of leaves us dealing with this whole notion, you know, of how did we get to where we are now. So let me kind of explain to you. For those of you who are relatively new to this, I'm going to give you about 30 years of legal history. I'm going to do it in under 5 minutes. All right? The legislature had a heck of a time trying to figure out what to do with Class C misdemeanors and children. They know how to treat adults who are accused of Class C misdemeanors, but when it comes to children, we've always had a hard time. Part of it is, you know, do we delineate between Class C misdemeanors that are penal code, like theft, versus Class C misdemeanors that are transportation code, like speeding? That's always posed a little bit of a problem. For those of you who have been judges for a long time, you remember that we have flip-flopped on this. The legislature has tried three different approaches on this. It used to be that you had to have two Class C misdemeanors equaled one chins, and then you had to go to juvenile court. It was mandatory. You couldn't go to municipal court. Then we decided, no, it's all criminal, and you got to go to municipal court and justice court. Then that turned out to not work. And then it went back to an approach where we were going to try to send them all to juvenile court again. And then finally what we came up with was this system where we have now, which is that a conduct which is a Class C misdemeanor can be filed either criminally or civilly. It's up to the peace officer or the instigator. They're the ones who get to decide where these cases are initially going to be filed. And not only that, if a child has been convicted of more than two criminal offenses, excluding traffic and tobacco, you have to transfer them. Now, the legislature thinks this is one of the reasons why you folks shouldn't be complaining. Because in theory, as soon as you get two convictions on a kid, and by the way, y'all are in a position to convict these kids, you get to decide how fast they're going to go to juvenile court. That I've been told by two policymakers that I don't know why the JPs and municipal judges are complaining. They have the keys to their own fate. They don't have to see any of these cases except for traffic and tobacco cases, and they can transfer a case at any time they want. I said, I'm so glad you said that. I will tell all the municipal judges I can this year what you have said. I will spread the gospel to make sure. And by the way, do I think y'all really have the keys? No, I don't. Okay, but I do think this is a tool that some of you are not using when you should, and it's a tool that some of you are not using when you're required to, and that's the reason why I'm here today to talk to you about it. Delinquent conduct, what's that? Can y'all tell me, give me an example, what is delinquent conduct? If it's a jailable assault, yes. Class C assault would still be chins. But, by the way, another example of chins, truancy. Civil truancy, you know what I'm talking about? Not failure to attend school. Another classic example of chins, which is unique in the sense that it's not just civil. It has a criminal counterpart that lives over in the education code. Failure to attend school. All right, it's twin, if you would. Sort of like GM, GMC pickup trucks. All right, now, delinquent conduct is anything that if you or I were to do it, we could end up in jail or prison. It's just that simple. Anything that would be a Class B misdemeanor, Class A misdemeanor, any form of felony. It also includes contempt of any court, including your court, okay? If someone violates one of your lawful court orders, that's contempt. You have the ability under Chapter 45 to hold them in contempt, put an indefinite lien on their driving privileges, pop them with another fine, which I think is a waste of your time, or what I recommend you do, okay, become the injured party, okay? When you become the injured party, you're now the complainant. Okay, you complain that the person has engaged in delinquent conduct, but only a juvenile court has the ability to find that the behavior was in fact delinquent conduct. It's a little confusing, especially for folks who don't study this a lot, that you go from being the judge who's the decider with the gavel to the injured party who's pointing the finger of blame at the young person. But keep in mind that if you are going to accuse a kid of delinquent conduct, you have to shift roles from being a judge to being the injured party, because only a juvenile judge in Texas can make the determination of delinquent conduct. All right? It's a jurisdictional issue. All right? Something else, we get asked this all the time. When I do that, does the case go with them? And the answer is, not necessarily. Okay? You can be the injured party and still keep the criminal case on your docket, but I would suggest to you, that might be a mighty fine time, Lucille, to go ahead and instigate the transfer of juvenile cases option and send it on with them. Send the whole thing to the juvenile court. Now, I know, listen, I have given this presentation a lot of times, and I've heard it all. Oh, Ryan, My juvenile judge told me not to send them. All right, I've been told that they won't take our juvenile cases. I'm here to tell you they don't have any choice, and you can quote me on this. And we're recording this for time immemorial. The law of Texas does not give your juvenile court judge, or excuse me, I should say, the civil juvenile justice system, to be more exact, any more discretion to refuse these things than you have to refuse the filing of a speeding case. It's the law, all right? So I understand that some of you might be thinking that transferring these cases is a waste of time. How many of you feel that way? Transferring, it's a waste of time. Juvenile justice system does not solve. Yeah, that's fine. And that's the thing. The question is, and let me just ask you, Jay, he says there's no consequences when we transfer it. What should the consequences be? And see, I go back to the fact that I think there should be consequences, but when we try to define what those consequences are, it's not as easy. I don't think fining these kids makes any sense at all. Because in the end, maybe we're trying to do some roundabout way of punishing bad parenting or poor supervision. But y'all know, I mean, like, I'll give you an example. You know, I know Lee Harvey Oswald never had his in court, but I'm one of those guys who will tell you the evidence was there to convict him. I don't think anyone ever thought for a second we should go prosecute Lee Harvey Oswald's mama for doing a bad job. By the way, she did a bad job, okay? But my point being, when I talk to a lot of frustrated municipal judges and JPs, you know what they really are? It just comes roaring through. They're mad at the parents being bad parents and not engaging in good parental supervision. I feel you, but we haven't criminalized that yet. And I don't know if we can. Constitutionally, I don't know if we can criminalize it. Maybe. I don't know. So we have a lot of mixed feelings about this. So here you go. Now it's going to be in 60 seconds. The legislature flip-flopped. They didn't know what to do with Class Cs. Back in the 1990s, we started hearing about these things called juvenile super predators. Y'all remember this? These were literally supposed to be like the children of crack-addicted women. And they were supposed to be soulless, have no conscience. They were going to be like criminal drones who would just go around, you know, burning down your houses, raping your daughters, and stealing your stuff. And really, the literature scared the heck out of us. All this talk about juvenile super predators. Well, in Texas, we weren't going to wait. We weren't going to wait for the juvenile super predators to arrive. We were going to take preemptive, anticipatory reaction. So we started rearranging our juvenile justice system so that the most serious offenders would be the ones who would come into contact with our civil juvenile justice system. And for those people who were engaged in status offenses or first-time offenses, we were going to use a combination of diversion programs, which is what they do in the civil juvenile justice system, and for others, we were going to basically sweep the burden off onto our municipal and justice courts, which is exactly what we have done, as you can tell from the chart. That is what we've done. Now, the next thing that happens is this. Zero tolerance takes off, and it becomes commonly accepted. Everyone thinks zero tolerance is fine until you start hearing about stupid examples. Kid leaves a butter knife in the back of his dad's pickup truck, gets suspended from school for 6 weeks. Folks, you all know that's stupid. Texans are too proud of common sense to ever condone that being good policy decisions. But that is the way that we've gone. We've really gotten entrenched with the zero tolerance mindset. Third thing that happens is a little ditty called Chapter 37 of the Education Code. How many of y'all know what Chapter 37 of the Education Code is? If you haven't, you should read it. Chapter 37 of the Education Code is called the Safe Schools Act, and it authorized every Texas school to have its own police department. Okay? You know, back when I was a kid in Vernon, Texas, if a police officer was on campus, that would have been talked about for weeks. That would have been scandalous. Today, students wouldn't know what to do if they went to school and there was no police officer on campus. Okay, so here we go. We start having zero tolerance. We start having police officers on all of our campuses. And then what I think was really the tipping point was Columbine. Because after Columbine occurred, now you've got a nationally high-profile incident where a bunch of disturbed adolescents going around killing innocent people. And now we've already got the apparatus in place. Now it's just time to... We've already got the apparatus, and now Columbine gave us the justification to put school resource officers in every campus. But guess what? The trench coat mafioso, there aren't that many of them. Y'all remember the trench coat mafia, right? Those were the guys that were supposedly, those two boys in Columbine were affiliated with. You know, God bless America, we don't have shootings on our campus every day. Thank goodness. We do not live in a country where every day a child is shot in a public school. It does not happen. But we basically actually created a police state in our public schools. And so guess what happens when someone doesn't get shot or raped every day in a public school? Cops are bored. They're getting paid by the ISD. And here comes the final factor. School attorneys have scared your school district straight about trying to discipline them on campus. Don't discipline them. There's a new way to go, and it's called municipal injustice courts. Tickets started being writing, and the ticket writing has gotten out of hand. We've got kids now who are getting tickets for wearing perfume to school, disrupts class. We're getting tickets for chewing gum. We're getting tickets for running in the hallway. And these are criminal processes that really the school districts don't care to understand, or they don't understand. It's probably the better term. They don't understand what's going, but they love it because now rather than clogging up the vice principal's office with all these disciplinary cases, I'm just sending them to your court. Okay? And this is where it's really sad. Is there any quality control in your court? I mean, is anyone reviewing or really thoroughly investigating these matters before they're filed in your court? Of course not. It's a direct file system, just like we would have on a speeding case. There's no prosecutor review. There's no one required to review these cases. And y'all end up sometimes powerless because you don't have the authority to dismiss these cases. The only thing you can do is take a plea and enter an order, either a conviction order or put them on deferred. And that kind of explains how we've gotten here. Here's the real big kicker, though. You know those juvenile super predators that started this whole thing off? They never materialized. It was bunk. There are no juvenile super predators. But we rearranged our entire Texas juvenile justice system for some, you know, day of Mahala that never came. You know, we thought we were going to have some epic fail moment and never occurred. So that tells you how we are today. Okay? And that explains why you're seeing this now. We now have more children coming to municipal and justice courts than are coming to our juvenile courts. Doesn't that strike you as being very disturbing that we are criminalizing? You know, look at this. We think that children who skip school should be treated like criminals the same way that people who rape and murder people. Okay, but one more thing, and I'll move on. Can you believe this? So let me give you an example. Two boys are standing out on a street on a Saturday night. They're throwing rocks at a window. Cop comes up, window gets knocked out. Okay? The cop gets to make a decision. He can decide to either take these kids into custody and take them down to juvie or to write them a ticket. Now, follow me on this. The, quote, bad kid mouths off, you know, he's disrespectful to the cop. So the cop, you know, puts him on the ground, handcuffs, calls him off to juvie. The good kid gets a ticket. Now, you would think that the cop just gave this kid a break, but follow what happens next, okay? The quote, good kid is going to have to show up in open court with a parent, okay? No prosecutor will review the merits of the case. If the kid is convicted, the judgment and the fine and cost are his. He's responsible for until recently, that record has been open to the public where everyone can see what you've done. You're going to carry that with you the rest of your life. You don't pay the fine by the time you turn 17, we have the ability to put you in jail on a capious pro fine, assuming that the municipal judge has done everything that the law requires them to do. That's pretty stringent stuff. No court-appointed lawyer, even though possibly they are entitled to an interest of justice appointment. That's another topic for another time. I've written about that. I will pray for you. If you are the unlucky judge who gets the borderline mentally retarded 11-year-old who steals the loaf of bread, I will pray for you. Because that's the time where I think you better go ahead and appoint a lawyer. If you don't have a prosecutor there who's got the common sense to deep six that case, then, reset and pray. And if that doesn't work, get ready to appoint a lawyer. Because that's exactly the type of interest of justice appointment. It's also the reason why TMCA tried this last session to create a fund that y'all could have used to have paid those interest of justice appointments. Okay? Here is the next thing. The bad kid, did the exact same thing. But think about this. He is never going to see a judge. He's never going to go in a courtroom. He's never going to pay a fine. He's never going to pay any court cost. Okay? He's never going to have a criminal record. He is going to have probably one visit with a juvenile probation officer who will informally dispose of the case. It will show up as a statistic, okay? And that's the end of the case, which is the reason why Judge Daniel rightfully says there's no consequences, okay? Right, because it doesn't even feel like one. They just thought that was a trip, Okay, so let's go one step further. Let's say that the, quote, bad kid, let's say that he, not only did he throw a rock at a window, but they find that he's got, I don't know, let's say he's got a little bit of weed on him. Okay, even if he didn't have weed on him, weed, okay, it's class C, I mean, it can be a class B misdemeanor. That would be delinquent conduct. Let me go ahead and make it drug paraphernalia. Let's keep it as a class C misdemeanor for illustration purposes. If that kid is indigent under Title III of the Family Code, the juvenile justice system of your county must provide a court-appointed lawyer. Whereas if that case had been filed criminally as a class C misdemeanor, drug paraphernalia, once again, there would be no easily accessible avenue for a court-appointed lawyer. Very disturbing, right? I mean, you're starting to see how the system looks like there's a lot of inequity in it. All right, there's where we are. Raises the burning question, do you have to hear every class C misdemeanor filed in your court? I'm here to share the good news. No, you don't. Okay, you don't have to. The answer lies in section 51.08 of the Family Code, which is your transfer from criminal court. Okay, this means rather, you know, it means that maybe a cop decided to file it in your court. I don't know about y'all, but as someone who's a lawyer, I think that ultimately, I don't want the cop to be the one who's the ultimate decider as to which avenue this is going to go down. I said that to you as someone who's been who's done some criminal defense work, and I know the criminal defense lawyers in this room would share my position on this. It shouldn't ultimately be solely the decision of the cop as to what's going to happen next. Well, it's not. Section 15108 puts the judges in the municipal and justice courts in the driver's seat in many instances. Okay. First things first, 5108 only applies to a child. And y'all need to make sure that you're clear that a child is defined as someone who is between the ages of 10 and 17. In other words, 17-year-olds are an adult. A 10-year-old is a child. A 16-year-old is a child. A 17-year-old is an adult. And a 9-year-old is not even a child. Yet Texas Appleseed discovered in their research they did this last year, they claim that routinely, 9-year-olds are being processed through the municipal and justice court systems and treated as criminals because there is no system in place to weed out those cases that cops are not either asking how old they are or they're erroneously being filed. Okay, and that's easy to see how a cop might make that mistake. You know, that's easy to see how that. It's not like kids carrying around, you know, date of birth on their person. And it's not like these cops are told that they have to conduct thorough investigations before they file these cases. They just write a ticket. And honestly, I think that writing tickets to children, that I still think that's part of the problem. Look, a child can't even enter into a legal contract. Yet we somehow think that a child can sign a written promise to appear. What are they going to do? They're going to get their Tonka truck and roll on down to your court? They don't even have a car. They can't even drive. They have to depend on their mom and dad that, you know, look, many of these folks are part of the problem. You know, not always, but sometimes. But let's make sure we're clear on the age. 10 to 17, that's who we're talking about here. All right. There are types of offenses that are subject to juvenile court. And here, the general rule is that most criminal cases can be transferred to the juvenile justice system. There are some exceptions laid out in 5108A. Perjury, traffic offenses, okay? And the other exception is city ordinances and county regulations, and but by the way, there's a typo here, that relate to traffic, okay? You can, in fact, transfer your curfew violations, okay? You can. Now, does that mean you all going to get pushback on it? Possibly, maybe. That's what the law says. Okay. Kind of begs the issue, you heard me talk about traffic. We can't transfer traffic and we can't transfer tobacco. I'll go ahead and tell you, this is TMCEC's historical construction of this rule. Let me tell you why we don't think you can transfer your tobacco cases. We don't think you can transfer your tobacco cases because the chapter that makes it illegal for kids to possess tobacco clearly says Title III of the Family Code does not apply to a proceeding under this subchapter. Well, that poses a huge problem because Title III of the Family Code is the entire Civil Juvenile Justice Act. It is the Juvenile Justice Act. Well, if Title III doesn't apply to health and safety code violations, I think that the indirect implication of that means is it has to be processed criminally and there's no way to transfer it. All right. A couple more questions. When a case is transferred, what documents must the transferring court send to the juvenile court? Judge Daniel, you had said that you have transferred these cases. When y'all transfer them, what stuff is sent over to the juvenile court? Everything. Absolutely everything. Do y'all keep copies? Okay. Everything's copied. You know, I had a clerk get into a fight with someone. Well, do we get to keep the originals or do we get to keep the copies? The law doesn't answer, and I don't think it matters. I would, if you're going to transfer it, I would keep the copy and send the originals. But by an evidentiary standard, a copy is as good as an original unless we have reason to believe that it's been tampered with or is fraudulent. Here's the next question. What about the child? Must the child be taken into custody pending action by the juvenile court? The answer is no. They don't have to be, but sometimes they are. And the way that can happen is, in fact, the first time I ever saw it done was actually Judge Daniel's court. Man, we've known each other a long time. What year was this? Like 2000? And I have even created a nickname for it. I've seen other judges do it since. I saw Judge Ramsey do it not too long ago in Denton. I like to call it stacking the deck. So how many of you have ever heard of this? Okay, let me tell you what stacking the deck is. Stacking the deck is when you have a designated juvenile docket and you've taken the time to go through and you're strategically placing these kids in different points of your docket so that your worst kids, the kids that are more like you've already seen them, you're going to transfer them, or alternatively, you already have a deferred order on them that you have reason to believe that they violated, okay, or you've already ordered them to go to school or what have you. You put those cases up front because what you're about to do is basically scare the crap out of the kids who have never been to your court before, okay? How many of you have done this? Have y'all done this? Okay, it's the name that I have come up with is stacking the deck, okay? And I saw Jay do it for the first time. I think that was about 2000. I know Bill Clinton was still president. It was the same day that there was the terror, that floating little rubber boat blew up the USS Cole. I don't know why I remember that, but I can tell you it happened there in that day. And this is what we're talking about here. Once again, the judge, are they in a position to hold that kid in contempt? Well, if they do, if you decide to actually hold them in contempt, the only thing you can do is a driver's license, lien, or impose another $500 fine. But if you tell them, this court ordered you to go to school, you've just admitted to this court that you now is going to accuse you of delinquent conduct, take them away. All right, now, where some of this becomes kabuki theater. The reality is, in a lot of places, that kid might be handcuffed and escorted out of your courtroom. Now, keep in mind, this is all for the benefit of the kids that don't know what's going on. The shock value is quite extreme. It's like some type of weird object permanence where they think maybe you all have just, you know, pulled a Saddam Hussein when you took him outside and executed him in the back of the theater. They don't know what has just happened. Sadly, what may happen is that you have a two-hour docket, and by the time you're done with the docket, that kid's back out on the street skateboarding and smoking crack rocks. You don't know. It all depends live. In other places, depending on what day the juvenile court's holding its dockets, sometimes those kids, once they're sent over to juvenile detention and they're accused of delinquent conduct, they may end up being there overnight, or they may not. It just depends on your locale, okay? But that's stacking the deck. And that is, there's definitely no requirement. There is no requirement that they be held in custody pending the transfer. I had a judge tell me recently, and I need to look into this, that the federal government has said holding them for any period of time, juvenile detention, violates federal regulations relating to status offenders. That's something else that I've been told, but I have not independently verified it, but I'm going to pass that on. Have you heard that too, Jay? Okay. Well, that's only, but keep in mind, that's for status offenses. If it's for stealing, but I'm saying it's not just for Class Cs. If it's for stealing, assault, or something that you or I could be accused of, possession of drug paraphernalia, I still think that there's a possibility that would be legal to do those types of detentions. But I'm obviously something new to me that I'm still kind of processing in my mind and exploring the legal ins and outs. Well, and you're right. You heard what he said. The days of staying in juvenile seem to be few and far. Yeah, they absolutely are. We have kids, you know, for those of you who do practice juvenile law, short of a kid committing a felony, scandal, there's no way to send a kid to TYC for a Class A or B misdemeanor. So for those of you who think you have no teeth, how do you think your juvenile judges feel? How do you think juvenile probation officers feel knowing that they can't even send a kid to TYC, you know, who's there on a Class A assault or who has Class A possession of marijuana? And now the focus is all going to be community close to home because studies show they do better when you close to their home, which begs the question, how do you define home? if their home were a bunch of gangbangers, that might not be the best place for them to be. But we're still kind of at the beginning of this new discussion. Okay, let's talk about mandatory transfers, because this is what some of y'all admitted you didn't know about, okay? This is when you have to transfer them. Now, the statute is so poorly written. I've got it in your materials, and y'all, and you can read it on your own. Our slides try to track language from the statute. Unfortunately, that means our slides also track a poorly written. I'm trying to give it to you in plain English. Easy for me to say. If you have been convicted, okay, of two or more misdemeanors punishable by a fine only in a traffic offense, and I think also other than tobacco, okay, then you are required upon the filing of that third case to transfer it. Okay? When you get the third case, you're required to transfer it. That also would include two or more violations of a penal ordinance, such as curfew. I don't know what other city ordinances they might have that don't relate to the operation of an automobile. Those two convictions. Now, how about this? What if you had a curfew violation and a theft? That would do it. It doesn't have to just be two penal, two ordinances. It could be one penal and one non-traffic ordinance. You could use that as a combination. Yes, Judge? Okay, that's fine. Everything that you see in municipal court, yes, because we used to have this debate, well, if I make them go to alcohol awareness, that means it's not a fine only. I'm making them do something other than a fine, and that's probably what you were thinking. It is fine only. Those are all considered to be remedial measures. Once upon a time, that was a real legitimate legal problem that we got resolved. Yes? No, they do not. And they quite often don't. Yeah, I mean, let me just tell y'all very quickly the biggest crock in the history of legislative drafting, and y'all have seen this. If any of you have read the law, you have seen this in multiple instances. If upon a finding of guilt, it is determined that the defendant has previously been convicted of an offense, it is a Class B misdemeanor. Okay, here's the deal. If it's filed in your court and you convict them and then you find and it turns out that they have priors, it doesn't matter because you have no jurisdiction over Class B's. This is a time-honored legislative draft approach that gives the effect of being tough on crime when in reality it doesn't do anything because they're not going to file these things in county court, so they're never going to be adjudicated as anything other than a Class C, but they still leave the legislative session feeling like they're tough on crime. And so you see all the time where these people will file these things again and again and again. Now, keep in mind, too, DSC deferred teen court, those are not convictions. If those don't count, you would never count DSC anyway because that relates to traffic only. But even your teen courts and your deferreds do not count. So for those of you who are super uber generous and giving out deferred dispositions, and I know so many of you are, keep in mind, the more times you defer them, okay, the longer you're postponing mandatory transfer. That does not mean, however, that after your first act of generosity, you cannot use a discretionary transfer the next time they show up in your court. Okay, here is the big exception. If your court has a juvenile case manager program under Article 45.056 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, you're not required to transfer these cases. Okay, so I'm just curious. Show of hands, how many folks in this room have a juvenile case manager program? One, two, three. All right. We're still trying to figure out how many juvenile case managers there are throughout the state of Texas. I will tell you, in light of developments this session, juvenile case managers are going to play an increasingly more important role in how these cases are handled. And I was mentioning to a gentleman during lunch that I think ultimately if we're going to get any parity with the civil juvenile justice system, we're going to have these case managers be able to review your cases without a formal complaint or ticket even having been filed. It needs to probably be filed directly with the case manager, let them review it, see if they can deal with it informally, just like our cousins over in the civil juvenile justice system. You don't see them, you don't get to fine them or impose a court cost, and only if they blow it, then your juvenile case manager or your prosecuting attorney or someone else could then have the case transferred over to Judge Daniel. But that's probably the direction that some of this stuff is working. Okay, how about discretionary? Well, it's very similar. Okay, you can transfer a case out of your court if they have no prior convictions. Okay, once again, you cannot transfer traffic offenses or a violation of a penal ordinance. Other than a penal ordinance or a violation of a penal ordinance or political subdivision that relates to traffic, you can transfer if they have one conviction. You can transfer if they have no conviction. All of this kind of follows the way that the statute's written, and I admit it's not very well written. Which kind of brings us to the ethical issues I want to talk to you all about. How could transferring trigger ethical issues for you as a judge? And the first one's Canon 3B9 that talks about a judge should dispose of a judicial matter promptly, efficiently, and fairly. Okay. One thing is, you know, letting these cases lag. I know of a judge who recessed and the kid invoked his right to a jury trial, and then the day before the jury trial, he transferred the case to juvenile court. That smelled bad to me. Okay. If he knew he was going to transfer, you know what it looked like? It looked like the judge was playing chicken with a criminal defense lawyer to really going to try this case. And only when he figured out that they were really going to try it, then he decided to transfer it, and he wasted everybody's time. He could have transferred that case at a much earlier setting. The other thing is that Canon 3B1 talks about a judge shall not be swayed by partisan interest, public clamor, or fear of criticism. Now, I only point this out to y'all because of the fact that, you know, we do have stories. We have accounts of criminal judges calling up municipal judges and judges. Cases over here. All right. Now, look, I'm going to tell you right now, if I were a judge and a juvenile judge said that to me, I would file a complaint on them immediately with official conduct. Okay. That would be no different than if a municipal judge were to call up a school attendance officer and tell them, stop filing these school attendance cases in my court. Judges simply do not get to decide what's going to be on the menu. You've got jurisdiction, and what comes your way comes your way. But when judges start, you know, look, I get to decide what cases I'm going to hear, which cases I'm not going to hear. The reason why, and I know for a fact we have had one juvenile judge who's been grieved on because of this. And I completely support the municipal judge who filed statements against them. Let me just say this. Part of it is because they don't like the fact that y'all have this power. They don't want, probably some of them would prefer that you not have a rule that gives you the discretion to increase the workload of the juvenile probation department. I've also had senior juvenile probation officers push back on municipal judges for this. So keep in mind, if someone pushes back on you, Canon 3B1 says you can't buckle. You can't fold just because of fear of criticism or because of the fact that they're going to take you off their Christmas card list. You just need to say, hey, look, nothing personal. I wish I didn't have to transfer, but unfortunately, the law is the law, and I took an oath, and that's what this says I shall do. All right? So that's one of those coils that's really out there. Which kind of brings us to the question, under what kind of circumstances should a municipal court make a discretionary transfer? So my question to you is, okay, who in this room has made a discretionary transfer? Judge, can y'all talk? Just give us some examples of when did you make a discretionary transfer? You didn't have to, but you decided you were going to. They have, like what, do they manifest? Because they're like manifesting physical symptomology, like they're disturbed or something? Okay. Attitude towards the court, good one. Judge, what do you have? Couldn't control them? Let me go ahead and give y'all some things that I have learned this year while teaching this class. I love this. I would encourage all of you to make this a standard protocol. How many of y'all do standard announcements at the beginning of your juvenile dockets? You know, you tell them why they're here and what this setting is. I would encourage you all to think about doing this. Asking them how many of them have a juvenile probation officer assigned to them by the county. If they say yes, boom, go ahead, time to transfer. Okay? Because the fact is, anything they do that could land them in your court can also be grounds for the revocation of their probation by the juvenile court, and it's important that the juvenile probation officer know about it. Yeah. Well, but is that a problem with our laws or a problem with the civil juvenile justice system? But Okay. Okay. You are making a general mass assumption that the juvenile justice system can never work. Right? I mean, now look, and I don't disagree with you. The stuff I'm hearing is that it fails more often than it does, but there's two sides to every story. I'm sure if we got some juvenile probation officers in here, they would be happy to say, well, here's my version of events and how I see the world. I understand. Well, I'm just telling you, this is one example. I think that's an ideal time. The other thing is, if you get that feeling that this kid needs resources and your city doesn't have access to it and you don't have access to it, time to pull the grenade. That's another good discretionary transfer. Well, and let me say this. The county is responsible for managing juvenile probation services. The only way this is ever going to get fixed is if they are made to do their jobs at some point in time, or if a light is shined on the fact that their system is broken. Yeah. Well, the argument could be made, too, they're not going to pay your fine, and they're just going to continue to rack up cases. No, you don't transfer the parent contributor. Mm-hmm. I understand. Well, but here's the deal, too. At the end of the day, who is supposed to be responsible for these things? I don't think y'all have been given ample tools, ample resources, and I can tell you that 90% of all juvenile money goes to counties to fund juvenile programs that are not controlled by Texas cities. All right. Now, what sources of information may a judge ethically consider in deciding whether to transfer a juvenile case? Are any sources ethically questionable? And we're running out of time, so I'm going to tell you the answers to this. Yes, ex parte communications. If you decide that you're going to start calling police officers, if you decide you're going to start asking your clerk to go fishing before the fact, we have a problem right now, because that is not something, even if you have a clerk or a case manager or a cop who goes to try to get that information, once they tell you about it or once you ask for it, you've opened an ethical conundrum for yourself. How do you get ex parte off of yourself? It's easy to scrub off. You have to tell the other side. So if you get information from your city attorney, he ex partes you, reduce it to writing, give it to the defendant, keep the letter for at least 5 to 10 years, and you're probably good to go. That's a quick way to get skunk scent off of you. In terms of defendants' rights, when, if ever, may it be procedurally too late for a judge to decide to make a discretionary transfer of a juvenile case? Let me say this. If the person is no longer a child, you can't transfer it. Okay? If you've held it so long that by the time you're going to transfer it, they're going to be 17, that's not going to work. Another time that you can't do is you can't transfer the case once they've been found guilty and they've already satisfied the judgment. Okay? But here's the funny thing. When you look at the statute, it doesn't appear there's any other restraints on when you can make the transfer. It appears to be a wide open country. All right. Folks, that is my time. I appreciate your attention, and y'all enjoy your break. Thank you.